We are beginning our Parsha class, and we're starting a new year, Baruch Hashem. We're starting a new series of reading of the Torah, and we missed Parshas Bereishis. I wish we will have an opportunity to fill in what we've missed, but we'll quickly remind ourselves what we read in Bereishis. And before we do that, we should just introduce the general concept of Torah reading. We know that God gave Moshe the Torah at Sinai. It is discussed among the sages exactly how was the Torah given, for the Torah encompasses a 40-year period. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was given the Torah, was he given the Torah that said, and Moshe Rabbeinu died at the end of these 40 years? Obviously not. So exactly how the Torah was given, that discussion will have to remain for our class on Bereishis, or a separate class. But in general, our sages instituted that we read from the Torah every week. There were two customs with regard to the Torah reading. One custom would read a third of a parsha every week, and they would conclude the reading of the Torah every 3 years. Another custom, which became the accepted custom throughout all of Israel, was that they'd read a complete parsha every week, and then they'd complete the Torah every year, which is our custom. The Torah reading of the week is read throughout the world. There are times when there could be slight differences. We could be 1 week off between Israel and Chutz Laretz because of the two-day Yom Tov, so sometimes you could have Yom Tov falling out on Shabbos. The second day Yom Tov in Chutz Laretz would fall out on Shabbos, so here in Israel we'd have a regular Shabbos, a regular Torah reading, and in Chutz Laretz they'd have the second day Yom Tov, and they'd have the special reading of the second day Yom Tov, and they'd fall a Shabbos behind. But generally the whole world is reading the same Parsha, and it is important that when we approach the Torah reading, we be open-minded. Sometimes people think, I learned that in fifth grade, Parshas Noach. I learned that when I was in day school. I know what Parshas Noach is all about. I know about the flood, I know about the raven, I know about the dove. Well, that reminds me of the story that Rabbi Wein always tells of the woman who comes to synagogue once, and she walks in, and they're reading in the Torah, and she sits down next to another woman, and she asks her, what are they reading? So the other woman tells her, they're reading the story about Joseph and his brothers. So the woman asks her, well, what's the story? So she starts telling her about the enmity between the brothers and how the brothers pounced on Yosef and sold him for a slave, and he's being taken, led down as a slave, naked down to Egypt, while he was the son of princes, now he's being led as a slave. And she describes the whole story, and the woman listening to the story is so touched, she's so moved, she's listening and weeping. And at the end of the story, she thanks her very much, and she leaves the synagogue. A year later, she comes back to shul, happens to be the same Torah reading, she sits down next to the same lady, they're reading, she asks her, what are they doing down there? So she says, they're reading from the Torah. She asks her, what are they reading? She starts telling her the story of Yosef, she's listening, she goes through the whole story of Yosef, doesn't bat an eyelash. So the woman asks this visitor to shul, she says, last year you came, you heard the story, you wept bitterly, this year you hear the story, it doesn't move you at all. So she said, well, last year I heard it was very sad. But if he was stupid enough to do the same thing this year again, I don't have to cry for him. So sometimes we could approach the Torah like that woman. Oh, it's not going into the ark again. Oh, it's the flood again. The question is, have we grown since last year? If the Torah means the same thing to you this year as it did last year, that means that you're in the same place you were last year. Hopefully we grow. And being that the Torah has limitless depth, so as we grow, the parshiot are supposed to have more and more depth, and we're supposed to understand more and more of what the Torah is trying to teach us. Throughout our lives, we can study the Torah, and we're not even scratching the surface. We're trying, but there's endless depth. In our class, our goal has been, and I hope will continue to be this year, to go beyond Rashi. The assumption in this class is that when you enter the class, you have learned the parasha with Rashi. If you do not prepare with Rashi, which was the case in certain years, I will be forced to lower the level of the class and tell you what Rashi says. But I would much rather tell you what other commentaries say, commentaries that you might not get to, like Maimonides, Nachmanides, the Tosafists, the Rashba, the Rashba's disciples. There's a conglomerate of works on the Torah, and my goal in this class is to try and sum up many of the basic concepts, many of the basic philosophies, and many of the mitzvot, hopefully all of the mitzvot, or almost all of the mitzvot, so that if one attends the class for a year, one will have come across many, 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 hopefully, I don't dare say most, but hopefully enough that a person feels like he's at least gotten a feel for the basic philosophies that our sages taught us within the Torah, and at least touched upon and at least be familiar with the concept of the mitzvot that are in the Torah. Now, in order for that to work, you guys have to do your end of it and be prepared with the parsha with Rashi. We always begin with a quick overview of the parsha, and we'll do that today as well. Our parsha begins 10 generations after creation. We know that God created Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve. Oh, I'm sorry, let's take one step back. Please, I try to translate every word as I say it. There are always new guys coming in and going out of the class. I try to translate every word. If I say a word in Hebrew that you are unfamiliar with, please point it out to me and ask me what the word means, and I will try to get accustomed to translating that word as well. The Torah begins with creation, which is a basic part of Jewish faith. A basic part of our religion is that there was a moment of creation. Before that moment, there was only God. And after that moment, God started creating the world. And in last week's parasha, in the beginning of the Torah tells us about creation. It's very difficult to understand what the Torah is telling us. You read the verses, they seem to contradict one another. If you read with a little bit of depth, you realize that the verses cannot be understood simply. But nonetheless, the Torah does take time to describe to us creation. And at the end of creation, the Torah tells us about Adam's creation and Adam's marriage to Chava, to Eve. And then the Torah goes on to tell us about the commandment to Adam Arishon not to eat from the Eitz Hadas, the tree of fruit, the tree of knowledge. Adam sins and he's chased out of Gan Eden. Adam and Chava have two sons, Cain and Hevel, with their twin sisters that are not mentioned in their Torah. Hevel has two twin sisters. Cain is jealous. Cain gets into a fight with Hevel. Cain murders Hevel. We have the first murder. Imagine if Cain wouldn't have murdered Hevel, the world population would be double right now. So you guys should have a comment on that, but if you're not asking, I'm not telling. Cain kills Hevel. Cain gets punished. The Torah tells us about the generations from Adam till Noah. And then in the end of last week's parasha, in the end of Bereshit, the Torah tells us mankind started sinning. The people who were in power oppressed, misused the power. They started taking women, married women, non-married women, whoever they wanted. When the people protested, so they started doing it in hiding. And you had mass intermarriage, mass immoral activity, people stealing one another's wives, people stealing one another's objects. People blaspheming, people serving idol worship. The moral fiber of society has worn thin, and the parasha concludes with V'Noach Matzah Chen Beinei Hashem, and Noach has found favor in the eyes of Hashem. And so our parasha begins by expanding on who this Noach, who was born 10 generations after Adam and Rishon, the first person since Adam was created that was born circumcised. The average child is born uncircumcised. When a child is born circumcised, very often it's a sign that he has hypospadias, the hole is in the improper place. It's usually something malignant, something's wrong with the child when he's born circumcised. But there are people who are tzaddikim, and they are born pre-circumcised. Adam was created pre-circumcised. And Adam, when he was cursed and the earth was cursed, Adam was told, this curse will end when someone is born who is circumcised. And so when Noah's father sees that this child is born circumcised, he says, Zeyenachameinu, this one will comfort us. And from there comes the name Noah. And in truth, Noah was the first to be born with hands that were not webbed. Everyone from Adam to Noah, their hands were webbed. Noah was born with hands that were not webbed. And as such, he could master skills that others could not. He could fashion utensils as others could not. And he fashioned utensils to plow and to make the harvest easier. And from Noah's time onward, really, they started seeing much, much better crops. Until Noah's time, they couldn't really take care of the crops well if their hands were webbed, etc. So the curse is over, and yet people are sinning, and God says it's time to destroy the world. Yes?
You said that people had webbed hands before. Does that mean that they were they had a vet, like they were into marine life, and they were based around the water, and they used to swim a lot?
I don't know what they did with those wet pans. The Pasuk says that they were focused on the dry land, that they were plowing, they were trying to grow crops. We find in the Torah that there were people who lived in tents. We find in the Torah that there were people who grazed herds, they were shepherds, and we find in the Torah that there were people who worked the ground. We don't find that there were people who were out at sea. In our parsha, maybe there's more of that. Our sages say that in last week's parsha, as a warning shot, so to speak, God made a huge flood, and a third of the world was wiped out with some massive tsunami, a third of the world population. So that was like a warning. Hey, there's a flood coming. You guys better shape up. Look, a third of the world was destroyed. And they didn't listen. And God sent them a prophet, and God sent them Metushelach, who was a big tzaddik, who was a prophet, and tried to preach to them. But we cannot focus on last week's parsha. That's all last week's parsha. We have to focus on our parsha. So let's quickly look over our parsha. We have Noach, he's a tzaddik. He has three children, Shem, Ham, and Yefes. God sees the destruction, the moral destruction of the land, and God decrees that the land is going to be destroyed. He tells Noach to build an ark. Noach, we have on tradition, spent 120 years building that ark, and God promises him that he will make it out alive, and he has to take in all forms of food and all forms of wildlife into the ark, food to feed the wildlife and food that will later on be planted to re-inhabit the land. And God makes a miracle, and all these animals come to him, 14, 7 male and 7 female of the pure animals, two pairs of the impure animals and birds, and they all come into the ark, and Noah goes into the ark, and the flood comes gushing down, and all of earth is wiped out, except for Noah and his little ark. For 40 days and 40 nights, it's raining nonstop. And at the end of this time, so the water is covering all of earth, and after time passes, The Torah describes it as God remembers Noach and the animals, and the waters start settling. And to make a long story short, Noach wants to see if there's dry land. He sends out the raven. The raven comes back. Noach sends out the pigeon, the yonah, and the yonah comes back. He sends her out again after 7 days. And the second time she comes back with a branch of an olive tree, and the third time she goes out and doesn't come back. And after almost a complete year has passed, Noach comes out of the ark. God tells him, go out of the ark. And Noach sees that everything's been destroyed. He makes an altar, he makes a sacrifice before God, and God promises him that he will not destroy all of the earth again, because mankind has a tendency to go for bad, and God will not destroy all of the land. The seasons will remain, and God will not bring another flood. God then gives Noah permission to eat animals. Until Noah's time, they could not eat animals. They could only be vegetarian. And God tells him, but don't think that means you could eat your fellow man. You're not allowed to kill your fellow man, nor are you allowed to kill yourself. And God gives him the commandment to procreate. God makes the covenant of the rainbow, that God says that's a sign that I will not destroy the land again with a flood. And when Noach comes out, he is permitted again to live with his wife. His children are permitted to live with their wives again. Noach plants a vineyard. He drinks from the wine. He gets drunk. Ham sees his father naked. He starts laughing at his father. The two brothers hear about it, Shem and Yefet. They cover their father when Noach wakes up. He knows how Ham made fun of his nakedness, and he curses him that he will be slaves. He curses his grandson, Canaan, that they will be slaves. And he blesses Shem and Yefet. And then the Torah tells us about the generations after Noach. And the Torah tells us about the building of Nineveh, the capital of Ashur. The Torah tells us how the different nations came about. The Torah tells us about Sodom, Amorah, about Mitzrayim. About many nations, the Torah tells us the Assyrian Empire, one after another, the Torah tells us how they came to be in these generations following Noach and his children. And then the Torah says they united to build one empire, and in that empire they want to abolish monotheism, and God scattered them. That's the great Tower of Babel that they built, and that's why it's called Babel, because Babel comes from Balal. Balal in Hebrew means to confuse. God mixed their languages. And then we have a recording of the different generations until Avram. We go 10 generations from Noach till we reach the story of Avram, and the Torah doesn't tell us much overtly about Avram, other than Avram, the fact that Avram gets married and he's traveling with his father, and his father passes away. And when we review it, we'll try to understand what the Torah is really telling us happened with Avram. So now that we've seen a quick overview of the parasha, let's start again and try to get more depth. The pasuk says, "Ka'avol sufa," just like a tornado passes. You guys ever see a tornado? You ever see how it destroys homes?
Yeah. On TV.
Oh. So I read an accounting of a tornado. A guy describes how there were warnings on the radio, and they knew the tornado was coming just to their town. They didn't have time to run anywhere. They were told those who can't get out should at least go to the shelters. Those who can't make it to the shelters should hide in the bathtubs. So him and his wife are lying there. He's on top of his wife in the bathtub, and they hear silence before the storm until suddenly they start hearing things moving and crashing. And all around them they're hearing trees falling and people yelling, and they hear all around them, it's as though the storm is right on top of them. And they're lying there in the bathtub, and they feel the winds, and they hear the doors of their house starting to slam open and shut, and they see their furniture being tossed all around the house, and they just hold their heads down in the bathtub, and they feel themselves being pulled by the wind, and they're holding themselves down in the bathtub, and they sense all around them that the house is just flying, whirling all around them. He describes how he's on top of his wife holding her down, and they're holding on to the bathtub for dear life. They're holding on to the handles. And he feels his wife's hands start to go up, being pulled by the wind. And he throws her hand down onto the faucet, to hold on to the faucet. And as he's throwing her hand down, he feels her rings being whisked off her fingers into the wind. And they're hanging on for dear life, certain that they are not going to make it. And after minutes of this terror, the hurricane passes, and they look up and they see that the house that they once knew is gone. Everything is destroyed. And after things quiet down a little more, they go out into the street and they cannot recognize the town. The town is completely destroyed. In a matter of minutes, the tornado has managed to take many lives, destroy tremendous amounts of property, and in a matter of days, it is gone. Tells us Shlomo HaMelech, Ka'avol Sufa, just as a tornado passes, and it brings great destruction, but oh, how quickly it is gone. The En Rasha, so too the wicked. They can bring destruction, but they pass like a tornado passing. For the moments that you are in a tornado, and I wish you never should have to be in a tornado, it feels like an eternity. So too, when one is in the presence of a Russia who has control, it feels like an eternity. But it's like a tornado. There's tremendous power, there's tremendous destruction, but it passes. Vitzadik, but the tzadik, yesod olam, is like the foundation of the world. You look at a building, you look at the foundation, it looks pretty simple. You don't even think about it, it seems pretty unimportant. But you come back a year later, it's there. You won't see newspapers reporting about the foundation. Hey, it's still there 10 years later, 100 years later. Everyone's going to talk about the tornado, but the tornado's gone. The destruction that the tornado brought with it is very real, but it passes. The tornado is no longer here. the foundations are here. That's the difference between a Rasha and a Tzaddik. A Rasha can make great turmoil, great noise, but ultimately he's wiped away. The Tzaddik, his impact is eternal. You had a whole generation mocking Noah. For 120 years, God is telling him, build that ark, and he's building it. And they're telling him, if there's going to be a flood, you're going down with us. What do you mean, old man, there's going to be a flood? And who told you? God told you? Really? You think God cares about what's going on in this world? For 120 years, Noah sticks to his guns. That's what God told me, that's what I'm doing. And he builds the ark. All these people, what were they doing? They were destroying. They were destroying the moral fiber of society. And when the time came, the flood wiped them all out. We have no remembrance of all these people. All the people who lived in Noah's time, we don't know anything about them. But Noah, we all read Parshas Noah year after year. Noah is the foundation of the world. Tzaddik Yesod Olam. The Tzaddik who is the foundation, he held up the world. Everyone was mocking him, but he held up the world. Noah found favor in the eyes of Hashem. He was a tamim, he was a whole person. There are people who are not tamim. A person who isn't tamim is a person who goes to read the tarot cards, a person who calls up astrologers, says, let me figure out what the future has in store. God tells us, tamim tiyeh m'shem lokecha, be whole with me, God says. I'm taking care of you. When we read the stories of the Torah, we have to know that the stories of Bereishis are there to tell us a few basics in Jewish faith. And the stories of Noah are there to tell us basics in Jewish faith. The Torah is divided into three sections. One of the sections are the stories in Bereishis. The stories in Bereishis teach us fundamentals of Jewish faith. One, creation, we learned last week. Two, God knows what's going on in this world. Three, God ultimately pays back. God doesn't pay back immediately, but there is a point of retribution. There is a point where God says, okay, now it's time to pay back the righteous for what they've done and the wicked for what they've done. That is our parasha. When we read about the flood, one of the things that the Torah is telling us is there does come a point where God pays back the wicked for what they've done. There does come a point where God pays back the righteous for what they've done. The whole generation is wiped out and Noah remains. Noah was 500 years old. Everyone else was having children when they were 100 years old. Noah reaches 100 years old. He's a married man. He doesn't have children. He's a God-fearing person. Everyone around him is pagan. They're serving all kinds of gods. And they're having children. Year after year, he's 200 years old. He doesn't have children. He's 300 years old. He doesn't have children. He's spending hundreds of years childless. You could imagine that the pressure was mounting. If you're right in your faith of God, why don't you have kids? Everyone else has kids. And if they're such sinners, why do they have kids and you don't? That is one of the challenges of the world. We know that had he had kids earlier, they would not have had enough merits to make it out of the flood alive. So God did him a favor. God said, I will hold you back from having kids until you're much older than everyone else, so that when the time comes for the flood, your children will be young, and by your merits, they'll be able to be saved. I will save them by your merits because they'll still be young. If I'll let you have children earlier in your life, like everyone else does, chances are those children won't have the merits that you have. Noah is one of a few people who saw the world in different stages. He saw the world built. He came out of the ark and saw the world completely destroyed, and then he saw the world completely inhabited again. Noah saw Avram. Noah saw Adam Arishon. Noah is a link that connects the 20 generations from creation to Avram. And that's a very important point philosophically, because what that tells us is that Avram Avinu met Noah. Yaakov, his son, met Shem, the son of Noah. Noah could tell them, I met Adam Arishon. I saw the first man who was created by God, and he told me that he was created. There was no one else out here. And he told me that everyone I saw were his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Adam Arishon could testify to creation. He was the one human being who could testify there was no one else around but my kids. Adam Arishon told this over to Noah, who told this over to Avram. So when Yaakov tells his children about monotheism, creation, when the Jewish people have a tradition about creation, they don't begin at Sinai. Our tradition really begins with Yaakov Avinu, who saw Shem, the son of Noah, who saw his grandfather Avram, who saw Noah, and Noah saw Adam Arishon. So when the Torah takes the time in our parsha and in last week's parsha to tell us how long each person lived, the Torah is really telling us, you should know, it might seem phenomenal to you that this whole world comes from one person. This whole world comes from Adam Arishon. How could it be? So many nations evolved. So when you wonder about it, says the Torah, I'll tell you where each nation comes from. And I'll tell you the tradition all the way back to Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Now think about it. Three generations later, got the Torah. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu was the son of Amram. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu was the son of Yocheved, who was the daughter of Levi, who was the son of Yaakov. Right? Moshe's four generations from Yaakov. So you have people there who are older than Moshe. You're talking about only three generations after Yaakov. They received the Torah. Three, four generations. Could you really lie and make up stories? Could you tell them something that... No, you try to make up history. People all pounce on you. So you could stand there and keep saying, there was no Holocaust, there was no Holocaust, there was no Holocaust, and the whole world looks at you and says, you're nuts. So you could say it over and over again, but the world looks at you and says, you're crazy. When the Torah was given and told us this recounting of creation to Noah, Noah to Avram, Avram to Yaakov, all the Jewish people were the great-grandchildren of Yaakov. So the Torah couldn't have made it up. So when the Torah tells us all of this, part of what the Torah is doing is also giving us a basic proof to the validity of the Torah. This isn't the only proof, but this is one of the proofs. No.
Shabbat, I heard something very interesting. In the last couple of years, we found a common trait in like 70% of all, I think it's either Ashkenazi Jews or all Jews. They have characteristics of four. They could tell everyone came from four men at some point about a couple thousand years ago. They can't tell you what these men were like, but everyone has in the genes the characteristics of four people.
Interesting. And yet? Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's why I have water. Noah saw the world built, destroyed, and built again. Noah isn't the only one. Oh, so here there are different midrashim. There's a midrash that says that Noah saw three worlds, and Yosef. Initially he was a shepherd, a prince, and then he was sold as a slave, and then he was the ruler of the greatest empire in the world, the Egyptian Empire at the time. Moshe was a shepherd, and then he's running for his life, he's a fugitive on the run, he's imprisoned by Yisro, that ultimately becomes his father-in-law, and ultimately he drowns the greatest empire, the Egyptian Empire, and he's one of the great kings of the world. So Moshe saw three worlds, and Eov, Job, he was extraordinarily wealthy, and then God punished him and everything was destroyed. He became poor, he was suffering physically, and then God repaid him twice. He was twice as well off as he was initially. He had double the amount of children, double the wealth, etc. One of the messages that we're supposed to learn from these people is that a person cannot let the destructions that he witnesses destroy his life. Many people saw their worlds destroyed. If a person had all his money in the stock market and it collapsed, well, you could still get back up there. I'll get to you in just 1 second. Donald Trump says that there was a point where all his assets were in decline. New York real estate was plummeting. And it was the middle of the night. He got a phone call from the Japanese bankers. They said, we want you down here. We want to understand what's happening with our investments. Now, he didn't have any money on him and he couldn't order a taxi. So he started walking from his apartment. It's a fancy apartment. He owns the building. But he's walking down the street on a freezing winter night to meet these Japanese investors. And as he walks, he sees a homeless person lying, asking for money. And he thinks to himself, he writes, I thought to myself, he's better off than I am right now. Because he doesn't have a penny, but he doesn't have a penny of debt. I don't have a penny, and I have millions of dollars of debt. So he's richer than me at this moment. A person can never give up. Noach saw the whole world destroyed. Yosef, we're going to learn, Yosef was sold as a slave. Doesn't get lower than that. If that's not bad enough, after he's sold as a slave, they bring false allegations against him. He did the greatest act of piety, and what's his reward? He gets thrown into the dungeons. Things can always look bleaker, and we always have to remember that they can always look brighter. It ain't over till it's over. So even Eel, he got every type of illness you could imagine. He couldn't even sleep at night. He was wallowing in pain. His friends just looked at him, they burst into tears, seeing how much he was suffering. And nonetheless, the world was rebuilt for him. So one of the messages of the parasha is not to give up. The world can seem destroyed. The world can be destroyed, and we can rebuild it. Yeah?
Can we say this about...
We could say it, but I'm not familiar with the medrash that does. There's another medrash that says it based upon the psukim, says it about Noach, Daniel, and Iyov. But about Ruth, I'm not familiar with the medrash that says it, but I don't see why we wouldn't say that. Yeah. So Noah's telling them that the world is going to be destroyed, and they're saying, oh yeah? Okay, if the world's going to be destroyed, there's no point in procreation. So they make fun of Noah and they waste their seed to the ground, which is biblically prohibited. And
what does that mean?
That means that when they were with their wives, they'd ejaculate outside. So they'd ensure that they don't have more children. They said, well, if it's going to be destroyed anyways, who cares? God says, I see there's total destruction down there. And God tells Noah, because there's theft, I will destroy the land. When one does an act of theft, whenever one does something that is harmful to his fellow man, he is not only sinning to his fellow man, he is sinning to God as well. When we do tshuva for our ben adam l'chaveru, between ourselves and our fellow man, we have to know that we have to do double tshuva. We have to gain his forgiveness, and then we have to ask God for forgiveness. And that is why, when we discuss mitzvot, the mitzvot ben adam l'chaveru, the commandments between us and our fellow man, in certain respects are more weighty than the mitzvot between us and God, because they are a double mitzvah. They're a mitzvah between me and him, and between me and God. When they were stealing their fellow man's wife, or they were stealing their fellow man's objects, they were sinning doubly. And about that, God says, now there must be destruction. And God tells Noach to build an ark of gopher wood, which is a type of wood that only gets stronger when it's immersed in water. And God tells him to make 900 rooms in the teifa and to align it so that the water doesn't seep in. Now, if you'll calculate how many rooms you need for all the different birds and animals on the planet, it won't fit into the teva. Forget the food you need for them, forget their excrements. So the question is, why does God tell him about all these measurements? What difference does it make? So on the surface, it's not understandable. It's all miraculous anyways. So God's telling him, build it to these dimensions, fine. The commentaries explain that the numbers do correspond to different Kabbalistic concepts, and that God protected him. So God said, okay, this is how I want it done. Whenever you talk about Kabbalah, so then you could talk about dimensions and things that are physical in a spiritual world. But when we read the parasha, simply understood, the parasha is a little bit difficult, because whatever dimensions he made, they weren't enough to encompass all the different creatures he needed. So Noach builds the ark. And Noach is a person who is both good to God and good to his fellow man. He is Noach. He is pleasant. Pleasant towards his creator and pleasant to his fellow man. But Noach himself is uncertain about the concept of hashgacha. One of the concepts that we learn from Noach is that God is really watching over everything we do. But Noach himself at that time was uncertain, is God really looking at everything I'm doing? Am I right? Is there really going to be a flood and I'm going to be saved? Is there really hashgacha? Does God really look over after each person? And so Noach himself, even though he invests all the effort into building the ark, until the waters are really coming down, he's still standing outside and wondering, is this really going to happen? Is the flood really, really coming? Does God really watch over mankind, and is he really going to destroy them? The flood starts coming down. Noach goes into the ark. And God starts making miracles for Noach. Miracle number one, the people told Noach, if you go into that ark, we'll come and break down the ark. If we're dying, you're with us. And so they do. They start approaching the ark, and God brings wild animals to surround the ark and kill all the people who try to break into the ark, so the people can't harm Noach. Miracle number two, God seals the ark. Noach goes in and closes the door, and God seals it. Number three, he's standing in the ark. He's in close quarters with a lion, a leopard, a tiger, oh my. And God protects him. God has seized it that they don't bite him. And now he has to work 24-hour shifts with his children. Now, the Gemara records that there was one bird, he didn't know what to feed it, and God helped him out. He had to figure out what to feed each animal. It wasn't so easy. And they were working day and night. They were spitting blood, the Gemara says. At one point, they were wiped, and Noach showed up late to feed the lion, so the lion roared at him and beat him, and Noach came out of the teva limping. Now he has to do all his work limping. Noach was working really hard in that ark. And while he's working hard on the inside, there's tremendous destruction going on outside. We have on tradition that there were giants. And these giants said, okay, God will bring a flood. We'll just go up to the mountaintops. We're not worried. If God's going to bring rain from below, we won't drown. If God brings rain from beneath, we'll just stuff up the holes with our feet. So God made it that the underwater depths came out with shooting hot water, and when they tried to close up the underwater streams that were opening up, the boiling water just boiled their flesh off of their bones, and they couldn't keep their feet there, and God saw to it that everything was destroyed. God makes a covenant with Noah, and here we encounter the concept of a covenant. So basically, if God says so, why can't I take his word for it? Why do I need a covenant? So this goes into the whole discussion that when God says something, God basically says it's contingent on certain precepts. If you live up to your end of the deal, then I'll live up to my end. I promise I'll do it, assuming you'll do other things. And when God makes a covenant, what God is saying is, I will do this. No conditions. This is what I'm going to do. That's one understanding. And God makes a covenant with Noah that he will bring him into the ark, and God does. God commands Noach that he and the animals, they don't procreate inside the ark. The whole world is being destroyed. They're not supposed to be with their wives. And that's a rule in general. When it's a time of suffering where a person's living. If other people are suffering, if a person's on the war front, so everyone around him is suffering, he's not supposed to go at night and have a good time with his wife. We're supposed to partake of the suffering that's going on in our proximity. Assuming a person hasn't yet fulfilled the mitzvah of Pruv Rvuv, he has to fulfill the mitzvah. Okay, what can he do? But in general, one is supposed to partake of the mourning that's going on around him. Okay. Noach is 600 years old. The flood is coming down. Noach is inside the ark. He's brought in all these animals. God made the miracle. The animals all came in. And he's bringing in 7 pairs of the pure animals and 2 of the impure animals. And the Torah describes the animals as man and his wife, and the birds as male and female. So the simple understanding is that the animals, well, they live with their wives the way a husband and wife live with his wife. So that's why the pasuk describes them as the animals, man and his wife. The birds, they lay eggs. So that's not the way a husband and wife live together. So that's why the Torah just describes them as a male and female bird. The Medrash says that the idea is that man and his wife, the Torah is telling us that God made it that the animals that came into the ark were all pregnant. That the man and his wife is alluding to the fact that they had been together because God wanted the world to be rebuilt. We have a recreation, so to speak, after the flood. So a lion, a bear, an elephant take 3 years to give birth. So God didn't want, after they come out of the ark, that it would take that long for the world to start developing. So God told Noah, take these animals, and the animals that came, God ensured they would be pregnant. after the flood, Noach sends out the birds. So there's great depth into the concept of the pigeon and the raven. But pshat is that he sent out the raven first because the raven happened to have its perch. The place where they kept the raven was right near the opening, so they sent it out. The raven goes out, and the raven usually eats carcasses. So Noach figured, what's going to be available right now? Carcasses. So he sends out the raven. And what's on the market, right. And when the raven comes back and he didn't bring anything, so Noach realized that he needs to send out some bird that's going to be able to fly far out and figure out its way back. And the pigeon, why do people have sending pigeons, homing pigeons, why do they use pigeons to send messages? Because the pigeons know how to tell their way back better than any other animal. So Noach sent out the pigeon because the pigeon, the dove, that she could fly out a great distance and come back. Our sages say that the Jewish people are compared to the dove because other animals protect themselves with their beak. The dove protects itself with its wings. So Rashi explains, what does it mean to protect itself with its wings? When it fights off an enemy, it fights with its wings. But there's another understanding, that the dove protects itself from being caught because with its wings it knows the direct path to fly. Other birds are searching, so they might end up in a trap. The dove knows where to fly. So do the Jewish people. They always know how to go back home. They know where to go back home. That's something which we don't have time to discuss today, but really there's a lot to discuss about Jerusalem and our parsha and the connection between our parsha and our quest to go back home. Maybe if we have time on Friday, we'll discuss it. The raven, our sages say, said to Noach, "What are you sending me out for? God obviously doesn't love me. He told you to take only two ravens. If I die, no more ravens on the planet. What are you sending me out for? Choose one of the pure birds, because you got seven of them, and then worst comes to worst, you lose one of them, you'll still have that bird in the world." So the raven goes out, and even though the hilltops were already visible, the dove could have landed on one of the hilltops. But birds usually, they build their nest on trees and not some kind of mountaintop. And so the dove comes back. The second time, the dove has a leaf of an olive tree, either from Har HaZeisim or from Gan Eden, that even though the waters filled all of the planet, they weren't pouring down in Gan Eden, so they didn't destroy the trees as badly as on the rest of the planet. The Yonah, the dove, this whole parsha really, there are correspondences to the Jewish people. The Jewish people are compared to the dove. The dove is a unique bird. When the dove has enough food, it's not so interested in its mate. When the dove can't find food, so then the female dove clings closer to its mate. That's the nature of the dove. So the Jewish people are the same way. When we have the food we need, when we have what we need, we have a tendency to forget our mate. We have a tendency to forget God. It's only when things start getting tough, when people have a difficult time with Parnassah, then they remember God. That's another comparison between us and the dove. Okay, there's more to say about that, but we don't have that much time. Noach comes out of the ark. And God tells Noach, come out with your wives. And Noach and his children are scared of having children because they're saying, you know, maybe everything will be destroyed again. After a person suffers such a trauma, they don't feel like investing in the future again. And Noach knows that he erred prior to the flood because he had improper thoughts about God. He thought maybe God doesn't really follow what's going on this planet. And so we have a special sacrifice that's brought for improper thoughts. It's called a Korban Ola. And so Noach brings a sacrifice of an Ola. And then God gives him a promise that he will not destroy all of the planet again. So then Noach and his children, then they again get together with their wives. when Noach brings his sacrifice, he brings it on the Temple Mount. That's the place where Adam was created. That's the place where Adam Arishon, Adam, brought his sacrifice to God. That's the place where Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel, they brought their sacrifice. That's the place where Yitzchak, Isaac, was bound. That's the place where the plague ended in the time of David. And that's the place where we have the temple, the Beit HaMikdash. So Noach builds his Mizbeach over there. And he takes from the pure animals and he brings a sacrifice, a korban olah. And God promises that he will not destroy all of mankind as he had. God makes a double promise. God permits them to eat meat. So we are permitted to eat meat. And God tells them, but you're not allowed to eat aver min achai. You're not allowed to eat meat until the animal's dead. And that's something which today, as far as I understand, they're not careful about. They start slicing up the meat to sell it before the animal is halachically dead. The Torah prohibits over here, what? Okay, but if I understand correctly, in the non-Jewish slaughterhouses, they do not wait. Okay, that deserves its own discussion. What? But they're still obligated by the seven Noahide laws.
So
what can we do? I'm not sure what we could do. First, we should be aware of the problem. Hey, what we can do technically, I'm not sure yet.
Are Jews eating
No.
Okay.
Shouldn't be. God reminds us that we're not allowed to murder our fellow men, which is a bit interesting because man is not some form of animal. So after God tells us, yeah?
If there is no
good question. That's what I don't want to go into right now. And God prohibits a person from taking his own life. We have a biblical prohibition. We're not allowed to take our own life, which deserves its own discussion. Does this mean we have to prolong our life as much as possible, or we're only not allowed to shorten it, or we're only not allowed to take it? So these are halachot. It deserves its own class. The Torah tells us, don't take your own life, don't take another person's life, and procreate. And here the Torah is alluding to the concept that whoever is not busy trying to bring children to the world, it's just, we view it halachically like murder. The person is supposed to try to continue the procreation of mankind in this world. The person, even if he's had children, if he can afford to have more children, he should try to have more children. Okay. God makes a treaty with the rainbow. Until Noah's time, the sun would not make a rainbow in the clouds, and God makes a new phenomenon in nature that the sun will form a rainbow. What is the concept of a rainbow? In ancient times, when people would go to war, if they wanted to show peace, they'd take the bow and point it to themselves. I'm no longer shooting it at you. God makes the rainbow, which is a sign of a bow pointing towards God himself, towards heaven. And God says, that's a sign of peace. Even though you guys might deserve to be wiped out, but I promised I won't bring another flood. I will not do that again to mankind. So a rainbow isn't such a good sign. We have a special blessing when we see the rainbow. We thank God for maintaining his covenant and not destroying the world. But it is a reminder to us that we are sinning on a level that really we would deserve a flood if not for the covenant. So that's why when there were great sages, when there were especially pious people in the world, that in their merits God wouldn't destroy the world, they would never see a rainbow in their lifetime, because in their lifetime God would never have to have that. God would never have to make a flood. Okay. Cham has a son, Canaan, and Canaan is born in the ark, which is a very clear sign that Cham has not fulfilled the commandment that he is supposed to separate from his wife in the ark. When they were in the Teva, Ham snuck away and was with his wife. And lo and behold, Ham snuck away and had the baby, Canaan. Yeah?
She couldn't have been pregnant
before? No. Pregnancy is maximum 9 to 10 months.
Right.
Okay, so the Torah tells us not that way. Okay, I don't know. It says so in the Torah. Otherwise, I wouldn't know. You're right. It doesn't say it overtly. That's a tradition we have. Now, in the waters of the flood, so there was a branch from a tree from Gan Eden, and according to some, that was the Eitz Hadas from Gan Eden. It was a grapevine that was swept away, and Noach stumbles upon it, and he plants this grapevine, and the Satan decides he's going to join in over here, and so the Satan comes and he brings rams and goats, he brings a sheep and a lion and a monkey and a pig, and he slaughters them over that grapevine, and the grapevine grows, and that day it's already producing grapes. And what the Satan did was he implanted within the powers of the grape that when one approaches the grape and he starts drinking, he's docile, he's like a sheep. And he drinks a little bit more, he feels like he's strong, like a lion. He drinks more, he starts dancing like a monkey. And when he's drank way too much, so then he's broken, he goes swathering in the dirt until he's lying around like a pig. So the blood of these animals were placed into the grapevine. Noach comes, finds the grapevine has flourished, he has grapes, he makes wine, he drinks from the wine, and he gets naked, and his son Ham sees it, and he says, look, this old man's still planning on having more kids. What do we need more people in this planet? It's going to be tough enough dividing it between the three of us, Shem, Ham, and Yefes. And so Ham, together with his son Canaan, they ensure that their father is castrated. Noach wakes up, and he sees either that he was raped or castrated, different understandings among our sages, and Noach curses his grandson Canaan. He says Canaan is going to be a slave. And he blesses Shem and Yefet, who went backwards to cover their father. They didn't see their father's shame. They knew their father was lying there naked, drunk, but they didn't look. They walked in backwards and covered their father. He cursed Canaan. He did not curse his son directly, for his son Shem was blessed by God. He cursed his grandson Canaan. That's an indirect way of cursing Ham, but he cursed Canaan. Now, Ham had many children. So let's begin with Yefet. But before we go on, we see here that the Torah takes time to tell us the details. The Torah is interested in the details of how we treat our parents. It's not enough that a person says, well, I did what I had to do. My father was sleeping, so I covered him. Did you cover him gently? Or did you cover him roughly? Very often we find that the Torah pays more attention to the details than the actual act. When in the end of time, the nations will claim, why don't we get merits? God says, oh, I'll give you a mitzvah. After a long conversation, God finally says, I'll give you the mitzvah of sukkah. They sit in the sukkah, God makes it boiling hot. They leave the sukkah and they kick the sukkah on the way out. And the Gemara says, well, what are they getting punished for? If it's so hot, they're not obligated to sit in the sukkah. So the Gemara says, you're right. The claim against them is, why'd you kick it on your way out? The idea isn't, why didn't you sit in the sukkah? If it's too hot, if you're suffering in the sukkah, you don't have to sit in the sukkah. But you shouldn't kick it on the way out. It's the nuance. It's the details. So the Torah goes down to the details and tells us, yeah, Shem and Yefet, they not only covered their father, but they did it in the most respectful way possible. The idea isn't just to be able to say, I did what I had to. The idea is in the nuances. Did I put my heart into it? The Kuzri says one of the wonders that Moshe did before the Jewish people was that he could tell them the history of each nation. People often ask me, what is Gog and Magog? So you open our parsha, and the Torah tells us one of Yefet's children was Magog. Magog is one of the nations. Madai, the Mede Empire, there was a person named Madai. He was one of the children of Yefet. Yavan, the Greek Empire, there was a person named Yavan. The Greek Empire emanated from him. The Greeks came out from a person named Yavan. Ashkenaz, Germany, there was a person by the name of Ashkenaz. He was a grandson of Yefet. And so we go onward. Mitzrayim, the Egyptians, there was a man by the name of Mitzrayim. He was the son of Ham. And that's why we say in Shemona Esrei in the evening prayer, Admat Necham, God took us out of the land of the son of Ham. The son of Ham is Mitzrayim. Kinaan, the land is called Kinaan because the people who inhabited it were the offsprings of the grandson of Noah named Kinaan. Ra'amah, Nimrod. Nimrod decides he is not accepting the fact that God runs the world. He is uniting the planet against monotheism. He declares himself a god. And he places his capital in Nineveh. He builds the city of Nineveh. And Nimrod tries to get everyone together against people who will be God-fearing. And so they build this huge tower which will unite everyone. And this tower is supposed to be so big that you see it from a distance, and when you view it, it causes a person to be awestruck, not to dare rebel against this great empire of Nimrod. And God sees that if Nimrod has his way, then Avram and those who want to believe in monotheism will have nowhere to run or hide. Because the way the world works is, if monotheists or Jews are oppressed in one country, they can run to another country. But if the whole world is united under a king that ultimately wants to lead the whole world to paganism and persecute and kill the monotheists, then there will be nowhere to run. And so God intervenes, and God confuses their language, and there is no longer unity among them, and that is the Tower of Babel, which is destroyed. We have 10 generations till we reach Terach. Terach has a few children. He has a child named Avram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, Avram, when he is a small child, there are different midrashim. One midrash says that Nimrod saw that they would have a child would be born that would rebel against him, so he started killing all the male children that were born. Avram's mother went out to a cave where she bore Avram, and then Avram was brought up by angels or in hiding by his mother. Even his father Terach didn't know about him because they were scared. Terach was very loyal to Nimrod. The famous midrash is that Avram at age 3, or according to other midrashim at a later age, 30s, 40s, Avram recognized that God is the one running the world, and Terach, who used to sell idols, saw that his son was being rebellious, so he goes to the king Nimrod, who is also called Amraphel, because Amar Vehipil, Amraphel means he said and made Avram fall into a burning furnace. Amraphel brings Avram before a gathering of people and he tells him about an idol. And Avram says no. And Nimrod says, well, bow to this wood. And Avram says, no, I'm not going to bow to the wood because fire could destroy wood. And Nimrod says, well, then bow down to the god of fire. And Avram says, I won't bow to the god of fire, for fire is put out by water. So Nimrod says, then bow to water. So Avram says, no, water is carried by clouds. So he says, bow to clouds. So he says, I can't bow to clouds, for clouds are moved by wind. So bow to the wind. I can't bow to the wind, etc., until he reaches man. Bow to me, bow to Nimrod. No way, I'm not bowing down to man. Man lives and dies. The only one that runs the show is God. So Avram is making these claims, and Nimrod sees that there's a threat to his rulership over his people if Avram keeps preaching monotheism. And so Nimrod tells Avram, either you bow or I throw you into the furnace. And Avram refuses, and he's thrown into the furnace alive. And God saves him, and he walks out of the furnace unscathed. And now Nimrod sees, okay, I can't win him. So he imprisons him for 10 years. The Gemara discusses he was 7 years in this prison, 3 years in that prison. But Avram spends 10 years in prison. Yeah?
So Nimrod accepted all the logic that Avram gave, but up to the point where...
Well, it seems that Avram was extraordinarily powerful and wealthy, and it wasn't so simple to kill him. Ultimately, he saw he had no choice, so he did. This is my own theory. Later on, we see that Avram was wealthy. I don't know if he was wealthy here. But you're right, the story on the surface, unless you say that there was some kind of political pressure.
How was he willing to accept everything up to the point that where Hashem came? What did he say about Hashem? Right? That's
so maybe we find the similar stories happened in the times of the Romans, that they felt they'd be much more powerful if they could break the individual than if they killed him. If you kill him, he could be a martyr. people will say, oh, you see, he couldn't win him, so he had to kill him. If you break him, then everyone will say, oh, you see, he gave in. So Nimrod is trying to break Avram, and Avram, according to the famous Medrash, Avram is this little kid who keeps answering him until finally he stumps Nimrod, and Nimrod says, I'm going to throw you into the furnace. They burn the furnace so hot that they can't even approach it. They put Avram on this slab of stone, and two huge guards pick up the stone and throw Avram into the furnace, and Avram walks out unscathed. They turn to Avram's brother Haran, and they tell him, Haran, which side are you on? And Haran says, I don't know, let's see what happens with Avram, then I'll talk. So after Avram walks out unscathed, Haran says, I'm with him. I don't believe in any of these idols, I'm like Avram. So they say, oh yeah, they throw him into the furnace, and he burns at the stake. Our sages say, we learn from here, when a person approaches a test, a person has to be willing to put everything into it. He cannot approach it like Haran. Well, if I see Avram makes it out alive, then I'm with him. Because then God says, if you're banking on a miracle, I don't make a miracle. So Haran gets killed in this fire, and he leaves behind two orphans. He leaves behind three orphans. Milcah, Sarah, which is also known as Yiscah, and Lot, three siblings. They are all three Avram's nieces and nephews. Avram marries his niece Sarai, and his brother Nahor marries the niece Milcah. They were both orphaned. Their father Haran was burnt at the stake. And the only one that's left as an orphan is Lot, who Avram takes along, and Avram really takes care of him. He's tagging along with Avram. Avram is told by God, go to the land of Israel. And that is where next week's parsha will begin, but that really occurs chronologically after Avram has already been in Israel and seen his first vision. When Avram is 70 years old, he sees the first vision in which God tells him that, and that's where we'll pick up next week with Avram's first vision and the commandment of Lech Lecha.